The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I wanted to start by letting you all know that one of the community members that appeared at this Sangha frequently, Thuy Nguyen, passed away 2 weeks ago. I think some of you may have been aware of this, but she was a regular member here. She was a longtime participant in my retreats, and I knew her quite well. Her delight and joy in the Dharma always inspired me, and I didn't have an opportunity to speak with her before she died, but I know several of her Dharma friends had been in regular touch with her. She was sitting with people pretty much daily. So she was in real contact with the Dharma and the community and her family. I was in touch with her family right after she died. And her family said that she really died peacefully and held by her family and friends and connected to the Dharma. So I wanted to let you all know that. This is just part of our lives that this happens. Thinking about Thuy gives me a lot of, remembering Thuy gives me a lot of joy and delight. She was such a light presence in this world. When I remember her, I often remember her in practice discussions where she was talking about some discovery or something new she was seeing, and just the light in her eyes and the joy in her voice and the way she was, just, it was so inspiring. So I wanted to say that and just take a moment to offer some well wishes to her family. And I don't know what Thuy's faring on will be, or, you know, often I think people, I hear at least in some of the teachings of the Buddha, that that moment of death can be so powerful for letting go and can be a very transformative moment of even full liberation. So may that have happened for Thuy. That's my wish, that she really let go deeply in that moment. And if she is still, if the impermanent tumbling on of her experience is continuing, may that move that being, that process, in the direction of freedom. And may her family have some ease in their grief, with their grief, not to repress or deny it, because that's a natural part of our process too. And for me, the topic that feels most alive in my own practice, in my own this past year, is impermanence. At different levels. And so that's what I thought to begin with today, the topic of impermanence.
Is anybody else having a little trouble hearing you?
Oh, let me turn my
voice. Yes, I am. It needs to be a little louder.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, I checked that before, but maybe my voice got softer. Tune this. Okay, is that better? Is that more? I can turn. I'm not sure which one I'm turning up.
Maybe a little bit more.
Okay, how's that?
That's good.
That's better?
Yeah. Okay.
Sometimes when I get, enthusiastic about the Dharma, it gets a little loud too. So, so I'm the topic that I'm wanting to talk about from my own practice and life, and bringing up Thuy also kind of makes this resonant for me, is the topic of impermanence. You know, all of our experience, everything that we experience in this world, in our experience. And this is what the Buddha was really pointing to, is what is our experience? Experience, sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, it's all impermanent. It changes constantly. We see this at a kind of an ordinary level in our lives. We know there's life and death, there's birth and death. A glance at the newspaper tells us this daily. The big events arise, and like the fires on Maui, and hundreds of people die in a day in an event. And yet this is always happening, and it could happen to us in any moment. The people on Maui who woke up that morning probably didn't consciously recognize this could be my last day here. So it's this awareness of our own human impermanence itself can be extremely powerful. If this is your last day here, and we don't know for any of us, we could be in a car accident, fire could come through, accidents can happen, we could have a heart attack, we could, you know, there's just so many things that can go wrong with this very vulnerable humanness that we are. This human life is just so vulnerable. If we really took that in, that this day could be our last, how might that change us? How might it affect our interactions with people? And acknowledging too, not only is it possibly our last day, but maybe this is the last time we'll see this person, another person or another being. How might that affect how we interact? So this contemplation, even at the level of contemplation and reflection of impermanence, of our human impermanence, which is kind of the most, in some ways, some of the most obvious, but hidden from us, you know, unacknowledged truth, that we are all going to die. I mean, that is true. All of us, all of our friends, all of our families, in no particular order. And even just this reflection can have a very profound effect on us. So I encourage that contemplation, encourage that, just that remembering. For me, this kind of reflection doesn't have a kind of depressing quality to it because of what it brings up, which is the appreciation for what I have now, the appreciation for what's in this experience. Yes, it's impermanent. Yes, it will pass. I will pass. All of you will pass. But the recognition of that can bring a kind of a more sense of connectedness and caring. So a connection, the metta can be there. The sense of joy and delight can be there. A sense of equanimity can be there. Be very powerful to acknowledge this truth. And it's in just a reflective way every day to kind of let yourself take that in. Everything, you know, we can see this at many levels. And we sometimes like impermanence. I mean, impermanence is not always something we don't like or resist because, you know, the birth of a new child is celebrated. The blooming of a rose is delightful. The arising of a weed, maybe less so. But, you know, there's arisings, and noticing how we are in relationship to what is arising and passing away is a crucial part of opening to where we get stuck, where we get caught, how we twist and resist or try to hold on to things that are changing, things that are impermanent. So there's the kind of the emotional response to impermanence, the feeling response, the relationship to impermanence. Sometimes we like things and want to hold on to them. We don't want them to disappear. Sometimes we don't like things. We want them to go away more quickly than they are. We don't like, or there's something that's disappearing and we don't like that. We grieve that. We don't like that loss. We feel things are too unstable. And so some of these emotional responses, you know, the liking, the not liking, sometimes it goes more into beliefs about the world and ourselves. So it's not just an emotional response. It can also move into thinking and beliefs. So the emotional response can have qualities of fear, confusion, anxiety, dread, delight and joy, wanting to hold on to something, clinging, craving more. So those can all at the more emotional side of things. And yet there's also, you know, there can be the belief side of things that if I were doing it right, then this wouldn't be happening in the way that I don't like. You know, that I should have some control over what comes into being and what goes out of being. So the sense of control, the sense of I should have some kind of control. Or somebody else is to blame for things arising and passing away. It's somebody else's fault. Or it's the world is conspiring against me, something. You know, that why me? Why does this have to happen to me? You know, it's like we have this kind of belief that it's only me that impermanence happens to. Sometimes we have that feeling. Now, I mean, it sounds silly when you say it because we know that's not true. But when you look at that quality of why me, you know, because that question comes up in all of our minds. You know, you're not alone, you know, that when that question comes up, you are not alone. And when you look at that question, why me? It's really based in a kind of a very collapsed view of the whole situation, the whole world. Because what happens to us is a product of many conditions coming together. Some conditions that we've participated in, some conditions that we've shaped, and many conditions that are just nature. You know, disasters like the fire in Hawaii, you know, that's shaped not that there's some human conditions that led into that, I understand, the broader human conditions of drought, I mean, of climate change potentially, which contributed to drought on the island, and then the power, the electric wire, the electricity not being cut when the wind started going. I mean, there's conditions that led to that. And some of it is wind, just nature. So what's important in our practice really is to look at these truths, this truth of things are impermanent. And what is what are our feelings, our emotions, and our beliefs connected with them? Not to repress or deny them, not to say I shouldn't be feeling fear or confusion or anxiety, but to acknowledge this fear or confusion or anxiety is happening, and it's connected to this sense of being out of control, or the sense of, I don't like it when things are impermanent. So these beliefs, these underlying beliefs, are really kind of the ground out of which the emotional response arises. Now, these three, I mean, these three levels that I'm talking about, there's the impermanence itself. At a very broad level, we've been talking about it just now. And the emotional response to it is what we might say that's where the suffering around impermanence comes in, is our emotional response to it. We don't like it. We want to hold on to it. The holding on to it creates tension, clinging, fear of losing something. And a lot of these emotional responses have to do with either liking or not liking that something has come and gone. So the emotional side of it is really connected to this second truth, their second kind of characteristic of our experience, that it's unreliable. So experience being impermanent is unreliable. We cannot count on it to stay, to construct something upon which we can land and say, this is where I'm going to be happy for the rest of time. This is how I'm going to be, you know, hold on to this. I'm going to create this place, this condition, and stay there. That is not possible. Everything that happens in our experience is unreliable. And that emotional response, and the emotional response to impermanence, is often connected to that unreliability. Now, the truth of impermanence gives rise to that unreliable experience. They're connected. Impermanent, because it's impermanent, it's unreliable. And some of you may know that I'm kind of beginning this kind of a trajectory of talking about these three characteristics. The Buddha talked about three characteristics to all experience: impermanent, unreliable, not self. Anicca, the Pali, anicca, impermanent; dukkha, unreliable; and anatta, not self. Now, this Pali word, dukkha, for unreliable, it's got multiple meanings. And so, you know, the unreliable characteristic of experience is that's always true. You know, it's not, things are impermanent, so they are not reliable. That's the nature. We could say that's the nature of experience, that it's not reliable as something to hold on to. The emotional response to that unreliability is often the experience of suffering, dukkha. Another definition of that Pali word, dukkha, meaning struggle, stress, suffering. And so there's this emotional quality to impermanence and to that unreliability that is why we feel the suffering. And so if we can open to the experience with mindfulness, this is really my own experience in my own practice at many levels of impermanence. This, you know, the level of impermanence at the ordinary level of life and death and change in our communities and our lives, in the day-to-day level. That's one level of impermanence. But at a very, very deep level, the Buddha pointed to, there is nothing in experience that lasts for more than an instant. The experience of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, the six sense bases. Every single moment, there's a new set of six sense bases that we are processing, that there's contact with our sense bases. And every single moment, there's a new set of sense experience. We can feel this in our meditation. We can see this, experience this in our meditation, just how rapidly things are changing there. And in that place also, sometimes that experience can be delightful of seeing, wow, look at this. It's just things are coming and going, and it can feel kind of light and delightful. So there can be a sense of joy in seeing that at times. And at other times, there can be a real sense of dread of, why can't it just stay put for a few seconds? You know, so there's a lot of emotional response to the impermanence and the unreliability as we deepen in meditation as well. So the same pattern that I'm talking about at the ordinary level also unfolds in our meditation. In our deeper looking at, even if there's no particular content arising, no particular thoughts about this thing or that thing that I did, or you know, some scenario that I wished I'd done differently, even when it's just sense experience arising and passing away, the mind can really have a resistance to this. It feels burdensome. It feels like just continually like you're this raw thing, perhaps, that, you know, there's an analogy in the suttas that strikes me as apt based on my, you know, my experience in the last few years of working with this process of a cow that has been flayed, you know, so lost its skin, and there are all these creatures biting on it. So, you know, that quality of just being so exposed and having sense contact after sense contact after sense contact after sense contact, it can feel overwhelming. It can feel painful. It can feel frightening and sometimes even terrifying. And so there's that quality of just intense changing experience and the wish for it to just calm down. Again, so that the sense of, you know, can't it just be still for a while? This comes into our meditation too, even when there's not much thought going on. You know, even when the mind has let go of a lot of the kind of ordinary emotional things happening. And so that that emotional response is really the dukkha side of things. The beliefs that are underlying this, that I should be able to control things, I should be able to fix them, you know, or, you know, even if it's somebody else is doing something wrong, or the world is conspiring against me, all of those beliefs are rooted in the idea of a sense of self, of me. And the Buddha proposes, he points to us that this idea of a sense of self is nothing more than an idea, yet another impermanent, unreliable phenomenon that is coming and going. Nothing solid or stable even around this sense of self. So the sense of self is a something. It's an experience that we have. But then if we start to look at it, if we start to see and explore, what is this sense of self? We see there's no one thing, no one stable thing that is what we call a sense of self. It is views and beliefs and ideas and emotions that are very familiar, and we kind of impute a sense of permanence to it. So the beliefs that are associated with impermanence, you know, when we start to look at the why me, the what did I do wrong, or what did somebody else do wrong, because the sense of other – The sense of other requires a sense of me. And so the projection that somebody else did something wrong is, it's kind of like the flip side of selfing. Selfing and othering. Othering is a form of selfing, an indirect form of selfing. So when we can recognize those thoughts, that's beginning to explore in our experience, that's beginning to explore this phenomenon of selfing. And as we explore the phenomenon of selfing, we begin to see it is not what we thought it was. We begin to see that it is impermanent. It is unreliable. The not self is not self in a way. There's no there. The there that we impute is yet another idea or belief in the mind. And so really these three teachings, impermanent, unreliable, not self, to me feel very connected. Impermanent is the nature of experience. Unreliable is how it affects us emotionally. And believing in a sense of self is kind of how the whole thing creates that suffering. Now, those beliefs don't necessarily feel like emotions. Sometimes the feeling of why me has a kind of a, you know, a feeling of an emotional quality to it. But sometimes it's just like, it's not supposed to be like this. You know, it's just a belief that is taken to be true. And out of that belief comes all of the suffering. And so the exploration of this with mindfulness, beginning to look at, not to resist those thoughts or those feelings, but to explore, you know, what is being believed right now? Sometimes those beliefs are so deeply buried that we're acting out of them without being aware of it. And when those beliefs are exposed, sometimes we can realize, wow, yeah, I mean, I think I should be in control of when some, you know, some disaster happens. That just doesn't make any sense. And so it can begin to undermine some of those beliefs, to expose them, to begin to recognize this is what is being believed. And so really the encouragement here, I'm going to wrap it up so we can have a little bit of a conversation. The encouragement is to notice that things are impermanent and to be aware, to be mindful of your emotional relationship to that, not to push it away, but to honestly know this is the emotion and it's connected to this experience of impermanence. And to also be aware of what's being believed. Emotions sometimes are a little more obvious. You can connect with the emotional side a little more easily. The question of what's being believed, sometimes I find just dropping in that question can be useful. So, you know, if you find yourself in a kind of a turmoil around something, an emotional turmoil, what's being believed right now? Ask that question. Sometimes if we ask those questions, it's basically allowing our wisdom that's can be there to bubble up, you know, it's allowing our minds to open to something that's there and can be seen. If we just make the space for it, that kind of curiosity of what's being believed right now might let you see some of the deeper underlying connections, and often those beliefs will have the word I or me in them, and that is a clue that it's connected to a sense of self. And so, okay, what does that feel like to believe that? You don't have to stop believing it. What is important is to recognize that it is being believed. This is what's being believed right now. Sometimes the seeing of it will weaken the strength of the belief. And actually it can go, wow, that's ridiculous. But other times it's like you see the belief and it's like, nope, I really believe that. I'm fully on board with that one. And so that, what does that feel like? What is that experience like to really believe something? How does that impact the body? How does it impact the emotions to really believe that? So that's a place to start in exploring this whole kind of messy a complex of body and mind, impermanent, unreliable experience. Every moment of experience points us back to these truths, to this nature. We don't have to look a lot. You don't have to look very far to see this. It's available in every single moment. So I'm curious if there's any comments or questions about what I've shared. I'm going to leave the recording on for a little while, see if there's anybody who's willing to share or ask questions on the recording. And just to say that if you have a question in your mind or a comment, probably others have it too. And so, you know, think of it as an offering to the community that you're expressing something, that you're probably not alone in this. So, but we'll see. We'll see if anybody wants to talk to the recording. Kate.
Well, I'm kind of like at this place in life where I've got, gosh, like five people right now in dire straits, you know, some older, some younger, you know, stroke, cancer, like just all of that. And I'm really noticing the effect on me of like feeling like, you know, the belief, I mean, a lot of feeling around anxiety, knowing that there's this thing, there's anxiety about, you know, impermanence and what can happen to us human beings. And then the belief that I think is in me right now is almost like an inevitability that I or Michael will come into some, you know, ugly state at some point. And some of it, one of the people is just having a horrible time with hospital stuff, you know? And so there's this, so I realize that there's almost the a lot of the fear is like, that's what old age is about. You know, this is what's looking us in the face here. It's going to be bad, you know, like that's really up. And what I this morning, as you were talking about that, and I was in touch with that, the next sort of like level of belief felt like all you can do is practice. And that has a feeling of, it's interesting because it has a feeling of like, better get going, you know, like that sambega, but like with kind of like a whip on it, you know, or a fearful whip.
Yeah.
And then, but there is some imagining and belief, like, you know, you're talking about Twi, you know, that the more one can practice, the more the suffering of whatever comes would be less, you know, would be held some way.
Yes.
So that's what's going on in my
Yeah, I mean, that, I think what you're pointing to is, it's probably familiar. Others have probably experienced this too. You know, the piece around that's going to be bad, you know, it's like that itself is picking up and holding on to some particular outcome. But the other piece is, it is a kind of a heavenly messenger, right? I mean, when you see this with other people, that's, you know, the Buddha talked about heavenly messengers, and it's a possibility. So, you know, it doesn't make sense to say, oh, it's not going to be like that. And that's our minds like this certainty, right? They want to know it's going to be like this or it's not going to be like this. They don't like the ambiguity. Our minds don't like this ambiguity. It might be like this. It might not. And, you know, and the practice does help us to kind of navigate that ambiguity. That's my experience. It's like the practice helps us to hold, I don't know. And to, I mean, I don't know itself is terrifying sometimes. You know, I don't know the next moment of experience. And again, the emotional response to that, I don't know, is an expression of impermanence. And the emotional response to that is often fear, anxiety, terror. And so the practice does help us to navigate that possibility, to hold it, and to have the sense, you know, what I've really come to is like, I don't know what's going to happen, but I do know that the best way to meet it when it does happen is to practice now, because that's all that I can do, you know, to meet whatever is arising right now. And that includes the terror and the fear and the confusion and the anxiety, to not deny it. Yeah. So, I mean, you know this. Yeah. There was something else that spurred in what you said that I'm not remembering at this moment. Maybe it'll come back. Thanks, Kate. Beverly.
Yes. As you know, I've had a strange, I don't know, you can call it a health problem, but an odd thing. And it's been going on for a couple of years. And what I found so hard for me to let go of, which is a kind of self thing that I've noticed, I go through many different impulses and thoughts and noticing of attitudes and beliefs related to it. But the one I've had the most trouble getting that keeps coming back is that I think I must have done something wrong.
Hmm.
This happened because years ago I did this, or last year I did this and I should have known better. Turns out that's not true, but I have so much trouble getting rid of that idea. And to get rid of that idea does leave me in this very, very kind of uncomfortable and uncertain place. It's almost like I'd rather know or think that I did something wrong, you know what it
yep.
is.
Yep. I think you've really pointed to the piece. I mean, when I talked about uncertainty, we like to know, this is what I did wrong so that I don't do it again in the future, you know, so that again, it's pointing to that control piece of, if I know what I did, then I can control. And so it really does take you to that uncomfortable place. So again, it's, you don't have to stop that thought or stop thinking, what did I do wrong? It may be useful not to go down that rabbit hole, you know, to notice when that thought comes up. But I find it's useful to come back to the feeling when that thought does come up. You know, so what is the emotional response when that thought comes up? You know, a feeling of tightness or fear, or so that's a place to let your attention see if it can be friendly with that, like you would be with a friend. If a friend was describing this to you, you know, how might you be there? You know, okay, yeah, I can be with you while you explore this hard situation. I mean, being human is really hard. It is hard. You know, and there are ways that, I mean, I think part of what you're pointing to is that there is condition, right? Conditions unfold, and there's a truth to that as well. And so there are times when we can shape conditions towards the direction of certain outcomes. And that's true. There's a truth to that. Now, we can't usually have it be lockstep. This is what the outcome is going to be. But there is a way to shape. And practice is one of those conditions. So, you know, the condition of practicing will tend to shape more ease and happiness in our lives. Not usually at the time or in the place or the way that we want it. You know, we want it now. You know, let it all go right now. But you know, so what you're pointing to is that belief that I did something is connected to that truth of conditionality. And so it's a little delicate. You don't want to say, well, it wasn't anything that I did. You know, it's like, well, I don't know, maybe, you know, sometimes it's like as simple as something is turning left or turning right. You know, it's like that choice, which is a neutral choice in the moment, that choice can affect the whole outcome of our lives in so many ways. And so to blame ourselves for turning right or left, it doesn't make sense as we think about it.
I tend to think I did something wrong. I did something that I should have known better.
Yes, right.
And that's where the catch is.
Right. And that's,
I didn't, that, obviously, or I wouldn't have done it.
Right, exactly. And that is that's the place of belief in the sense of self having control. And it is just an erroneous belief. And so, you know, again, you know, you don't have to try to stop believing it, but just notice this doesn't make any sense. And yet I'm believing it. You know, it takes a lot of trust to meet experience in this way, where we don't try to change what we see as silly. You know, it's like, how can I be blaming myself for this? You know, it's silly, but some part of us still is holding on to that wish for control. And, you know, to just know that. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it makes sense that we want to control. And we can't ultimately control. Oh, Christina. So we're just about, we're almost done. Is it, I'm also happy to stay after and respond. So if it's a quick thing, I can take it now. But if not, if you think it might be a longer response and you'd like to stay for a few more minutes, we can stop the recording. And
thank you. I can make it brief. I think what came up for me is this idea of these thoughts that we have and that we take them as our truth, right? But that truth comes with a past that we carry with us and ways we've related or how we were raised or whatever. And so, for me, it's that reminder of just holding it lightly and being curious. And also this belief about impermanence, this idea of this will morph into something else.
Yes.
And it kind of allows for like a lighter sense of clinging.
Exactly. And that is so helpful. You know, when we can hold our thoughts more lightly, it can help us to hold our emotions more lightly as well. So that's beautiful. Thank you for that. Yeah.